Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to the New Books in Hindu Studies podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran, and today I get to speak with Dr. Chad Bauman from Butler University on his fascinating new book, Anti-Christian Violence in India. Hello, Chad, and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
The pleasure is mine. And your interview is timely in the timeless time of podcast land. Know that this is the first one that I'm recording in this calendar year, 2021. And we are in the cusp of a really exciting and important change, tweak in the podcast. It may be official already by the time you hear this, but nothing is changing except the title of the podcast. Rather than New Books in Hindu Studies, this will now henceforth be known as the New Books in Indian Religions podcast. And if you're wondering why, listen to this podcast and you'll understand that there's so much going on in what we call India and South Asia that can't quite fit into Hinduism, right? And so we've had Jainism studies on this podcast. Today we're having a study on the relationship between Christianity and Hinduism within India and the frame Indian religions is being implemented for the sake of inclusion. But nothing else will change, except it'll afford me the opportunity to invite a broader range of scholars on the podcast. So, Chad, you're the first one under this umbrella. How do you feel?
That's a little daunting.
Daunting. I think he means honored and excited, but either way.
Of course, that's exactly what I mean. Yeah.
Yeah. So, how did you come about writing a book called Anti-Christian Violence in India? Tell us about that journey.
Yeah, you know, it's as academic trajectories go and research trajectories go, it was somewhat accidental. It's kind of the development of a research project that was planned in some ways and in other ways was just kind of the way things went. So I did my dissertation on the colonial interaction of Hindus and Christians in the state of Chhattisgarh. And that research took me right up to the year 1947, independence. And in that year, tensions were beginning to rise in the region between Hindus and Christians. And so I began to wonder, you know, what was going on? Because Hindu-Christian conflict, Hindu-Christian violence has not always been a feature of the relations between Hindus and Christians in India. So it was sort of a natural progression from the research that took me right up until 1947 to research that went beyond 1947. And I became really fascinated with this question of why Hindus and Christians were beginning to conflict with one another and why violence between them was beginning to rise. And so then I started in on that project and I was beginning to focus a little bit on why Pentecostals and charismatic Christians in India were just disproportionately targeted in anti-Christian violence when an opportunity arose through a grant that came from the Center for Religion and Civic Culture at USC to join a project that gave me support to do that research in a much broader way. And that led then to the book I did before this one, Pentecostalism, Proselytization, and Anti-Christian Violence in India, which is a more specific book looking at the more specific question of the disproportionate targeting of Pentecostals in that violence. But it also allowed me to gather the data for this second, more general book, which is really just an investigation of why today there is conflict between Hindus and Christians and why there is anti-Christian violence.
So when you say gather the data for this book, do you want to school me on what you've looked at? And also you mentioned at the outset that this is fairly recent. And so do you want to talk about perhaps, I think you mentioned in your book that 1982 is the first real example of this. So maybe you could talk about the when and the what you're looking at in your book.
Sure. There have been periodic violent conflicts between Hindus and Christians, particularly since the arrival of Europeans. And as colonialism came to be more and more entrenched and Christianity became more and more associated both with colonial powers and with lower caste Indians, conflict between people understanding themselves as Hindu, a distinct religion, and people understanding themselves as Christian, a distinct religion, came to be more and more common. But it was still very, very unusual up until the late 1990s. And that's when, as you say, in 1998, there was a riot in the Dongs of Gujarat. And it wasn't nearly as bad as the more recent riots in Kandamal, Orisha, in 2007 and 2008. But it did mark a kind of turning point in history. And so since the late 1990s, we've seen a kind of exponential increase from a few isolated incidents a year to something more like several hundred a year. And that number has been pretty steady now for the last decade or so, actually more for the last two decades, really. So that's the sort of when. The how of the data collection, my projects have generally been interdisciplinary. So I started off with some statistical data collection, just trying to collect news reporting and human rights organization reporting of incidents of anti-Christian violence, keeping a spreadsheet of them. I have an extensive spreadsheet for the years 2007 and 2008, and then doing some statistical work to see what kind of correlations that one can find between incidents of violence and, say, the party in power in a state, economic issues in the state, competition, economic disparity, the extent to which people are employed or unemployed, gender ratio, all kinds of things like this, the things that people who look at violence and conflict tend to look at. I did that work with a colleague of mine, Tamara Leach, who's the numbers person who knows this kind of research much better than me, but it did allow me to look in a more sociological or statistical way at what was going on and try to develop some sort of thesis. And then in addition to that, I just spent a lot of time interviewing people really all around India, except in the Northeast, just talking to people who had been victims of violence, people who were human rights activists, who had different kinds of perspectives on the reasons for the violence, different kinds of interpretations of why these things were happening. I also talked to a number of people who were very supportive of the attempts by certain people within Sangh organizations to marginalize Christians, so people who were very critical of Christianity, and tried to just develop a useful theory, a useful explanation for the variety of factors that contributed to this conflict between Hindus and Christians, and occasionally anti-Christian violence.
And so then, to what do you attribute this violence?
Well, that's a difficult, and maybe, well, I don't know if you want the short answer or the long answer. I really set about in this book to write a more complicated, to tell a more complicated story about anti-Christian violence than is usually told. So one of the ways I did that was by trying to ratchet down the rhetoric, perpetuating neither the crassest of the song's critiques of Christianity, nor the crassest, most exaggerated and shrill accounts of anti-Christian violence that we often get from Christian advocacy groups. I also set about, you know, right from the beginning to acknowledge and even emphasize from the first paragraph of the book that anti-Christian violence and Hindu-Christian conflict in India also affects Hindus in very real and negative ways. And of course, one of the central incidents in the round of riots that happened in Orissa in 2007 and 2008 was the assassination of a controversial but very beloved Hindu Swami, Swami Lakshmananda Saraswati, along with several of his supporters. And so I tried to tell a story here that was attentive to all of the kind of suffering that was involved here and didn't fall into the trap, you know, of atrocity literature that just kind of looks only at things from one perspective. But in terms of my explanation for why we have anti-Christian violence in India, I really tried to resist unicausal explanations. I was inspired here by the work of Mark Taylor, who talks about the webbiness of all social phenomena, how things are connected through different kind of social and technological and human and cultural networks, and by Arjuna Padrai and his insistence that the what he calls the geography of anger is always the spatial outcome of interactions between faraway events and proximate fears. That's what he talks about. So I wanted to resist explanations that focused exclusively on one factor: politics, economics, the provocation of proselytization, anti-Dalit prejudice, et cetera. I wanted to resist theories that were only local, that looked only to India and did not consider India in the context of global flows of ideas and political machinations and political power and wealth. And, you know, unicausal explanations have an admirable parsimony, but that alone should not recommend them to us. In fact, I think it should make us suspicious of them. So I then, because of this desire to resist unicausal explanations, I adopted a constructivist approach to anti-Christian violence, because I think it allows us to be more attentive to this complexity. And here's what I mean when I say constructivist. First, just the literal meaning of the term. Interreligious conflict and Hindu Christian conflict is constructed. So I'll maybe say a bit more about what I mean by that. Constructivism as an approach to interreligious conflict or to conflict in general accepts the best insights of instrumentalist theories, which focus on material self-interest, and the best instincts of essentialist theories, which focus on culture. So constructivism accepts from instrumentalists that economic competition is a major driver of conflict, and from essentialists that cultural differences and therefore religious differences matter, but maybe not always in the way that people imagine. But constructivists also take note that neither the instrumentalist nor the essentialist theory can fully account for why people conflict. So you could say lots of people are in economic conflict. Lots of people have different religious and cultural characteristics, and yet they don't always come to conflict. So constructivists want to ask the question, why here and why now? And that requires attention to history. So the second thing that I think is distinctive about the constructive approach is this attention to history, to try to answer the question, why here and why now? And of course, a full chapter in this book is given to what's called the prehistory of Hindu-Christian conflict. That is, you know, there was a millennium of time in which there were Christians in India who did not conceive of themselves as a religious community we might call Christian against a religious community we might call Hindu, and such that Hindus, quote unquote, and Christians were not conflicting in any way we would consider a kind of religious conflict. 1,000 years. So we have to keep that in mind when we're talking about the contemporary, when we're considering the contemporary period. And then the third way that I think the constructivist account is distinctive is that it acknowledges that local factors are not the only thing going on, that local dynamics take place in the context of global flows of wealth, power, politics, and that we need to realize that, particularly in today's globalized world, conflicts that appear to be local often have global elements to them. And then the final thing that I think is useful about the constructivist account is that because it recognizes the historical nature of the development of such conflicts, it can be used to emphasize the contingency of contemporary conflicts. Hindu-Christian conflict today is contingent. It's not necessary. It developed through this historical trajectory that is not necessary, not inherent in the dynamics of Hindus and Christians and their differences. And therefore, I think, can be walked back. This is, you know, the contingency of conflict should give us some hope that it can be walked back. And then I would say, finally, that all of this kind of approach leads to what is probably the most distinctive element of the book's argument, which is that anti-Christian violence in India is at least in part, and I want to emphasize the in part, at least in part, in addition to things like politics, economics, proselytization, anti-Dalit prejudice, et cetera, a manifestation of resistance to the feared imposition of Western and particularly American forms of secularism, that in their totalizing nature and their pretensions to universality are justifiably seen as a challenge to India's own distinct brand of secularism and the distinctive way that brand of secularism, that Indian brand of secularism, structures Indian society. And it is therefore also Western kind of secular modernities are also a threat to India's traditional elites who are favored by this status quo in India today. So Indian Christians are not Western secularists by definition. Christianity does not equal Western or American secularism. But in India, in my interviews, I found that a lot of Hindus perceive Christians as the primary purveyors and beneficiaries of Western forms of secular modernity. And they are criticized and harassed and sometimes attacked as a result of that perception. And this thesis, I think, is also useful because it helps us explain why proselytization and conversion are such flashpoints in the relations of Hindus and Christians in contemporary India. And that's because proselytization and conversion presume and depend upon the existence of a very typically Western secularist definition of religion, of something that's private, individual, and portable, as opposed to the far more common Hindu and broadly Indian understanding of religion as something public, communal, and tied to a particular people and land. So the thesis here suggests that religions matter, religious differences matter, but really only as part of a larger kind of civilizational differences that think of religion itself differently. So we've got an interreligious conflict here, which in addition to whatever else it might be about, is also about the very definition of religion, what religion is and should be like. And we've got different ideas in India, different ideas around the world, and at least a very small part of the conflict between Hindus and Christians in India is related to those larger disagreements.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So there are a number of themes I'd like to touch on in what you share. Prior to that, just for the sake of clarification, who are these Christians that you're speaking of in the book?
So this particular book didn't focus on any particular group of Christians. As I mentioned, my previous book did focus on the disproportionate targeting of Pentecostals and to a lesser extent, Pentecostalized evangelicals in India. This book focuses on Christians in general, although we can make some distinctions within that category. So the first distinction to make is that whereas in the isolated, more everyday incidents of violence that happen in a kind of disconnected way across India, you know, maybe one or two a day on average. In those incidents, what we usually find is the intentional targeting of a particular person or group who has run afoul of local actors for one reason or another, oftentimes for proselytizing boldly, sometimes just for having the good or bad luck of being at the head of a church community that's growing. And so there may be locals who are resistant to that growth, who want to try to intimidate or harass that community, and they may attack it in a very intentional way. So in those kinds of attacks, we do see disproportionate targeting of the more evangelistic, the more proselytizing forms of Christianity. When the violence becomes a riot, as it did in the Dongs in Gujarat in 1998, as it did in Kandamal and Orissa in 2007 and 2008, then the targets are far more indiscriminate. And to some extent, the larger, more established denominations become the targets because you can find their churches, you can find their buildings, you can find their schools. They have an established presence. So often in that violence, even though it may have been to some extent the proselytization of more assertively evangelistic Christians that created an offense the violence might target everybody and anybody. But we should say that in general, certain forms of Christianity in India do have more of a dominant caste orientation. And because of that dominant caste orientation have tended to be somewhat perceived as somewhat more thoroughly Indianized and more Indian, and have tended to be left alone. So the St. Thomas Christians in Kerala and other parts of southern India are often perceived as a dominant caste community. And it's frequently the case that they will ally with other dominant castes from other religious communities against their Christian co-religionists. So you have the interesting intersectionality here of caste and religion, and people will ally themselves in complicated ways along those spectrums and along those lines of division. Similarly, some of the more established Protestant and Catholic communities in India have been far less evangelistic. Their missionary impulse is expressed largely through social service, and they tend not as frequently to provoke a kind of reactionary response because they are not growing in the same way, and because they are not sort of out in the streets proselytizing or criticizing other religions. So there are some divisions within Christianity, and in fact, those more established Indian Christian communities, the St. Thomas Christians, the Catholic Christians, some of the more established Protestant Christian communities, they do often tend to leave their Pentecostal and evangelical co-religionists hanging high and dry in times of conflict because they want to separate themselves from them. And in some ways, they do blame those other forms of Christianity for provoking the conflict that sometimes ends up targeting and negatively affecting all Christians.
What role does race play, if any, in this conflict?
I don't think that race plays a particularly prominent role. There are regional differences that play into this. Southern Indian Christians, for example, are so numerous that they often move into the North Indian areas and start proselytizing, and they're seen as foreign missionaries. So you have these sort of Kerala Christians or Tamil Christians moving into Gujarat and proselytizing among Gujaratis, and the Gujaratis perceive them as somehow foreign, right? So there are these regional differences, the same with the Northeast and the rest of India. There are, to some degree, you do hear some things that might verge on a kind of racist critique, for example, of Korean Christian missionaries in India, perceived as being foreign again, which I think is the primary issue, but it's also that they are non-Indian. But I think, if we're looking for factors, you know, other than religion, other than politics and economics, et cetera, I do think that the intercaste and intercommunity dynamics in India are probably far more prominent than race.
So as you were describing, you know, the gist of your book earlier, you touched on what I think you're saying is a conflation of Christianity with Western secular modernity. Could you say a little bit more about that? That's an interesting point.
Yeah, and I think we have to keep well in mind that this is a conflation. The word you used was very appropriate. The argument here is not that Christianity is inextricably connected to Western secular modernities. And I try all the time to put that in the plural to acknowledge, of course, that there is a great deal of variety among forms of secularism, even just in Europe and North America. And we should also keep in mind that America's form of separation of church and state is really an outlier globally, even among Christian countries, even among Western countries. It's a very distinctive form of secularism. But Christianity, since the colonial period in India, has been associated with the Western world. Now, I said already, there was this millennium from the early centuries of the Common Era right up until the arrival of the Portuguese, when you couldn't have made that assertion. Christianity at that time was, if it was associated with any place foreign, it was associated with the Middle East, with Syria, et cetera, and the Church of the East. So, it just didn't make any sense at that point to think of Christianity as somehow Western. But after the colonial period and the way that colonial rulers privileged and allied themselves with Christians, and the way that Christians in India who had been there before the arrival of European colonial figures began slowly to ally themselves with the colonial authorities, Christianity came to be perceived as a foreign Western religion. And of course, the lands in which Christianity predominated were, until at least the beginning of the 20th century, predominantly Western lands. That's shifted now, of course, but in terms of who the world thinks of as Christian, that's still, despite the statistics, still a kind of North European or North American. There is this long association of Christianity with colonialism, and there is this long suspicion, at least since the colonial period in India, that Christians in India have divided loyalties, and that they're really loyal to their kind of Western overlords. And that assertion is based in part on the fact that there has been long historical financial support for missions, Christian missions in India that comes from the West, as well as the fact that there is continuing charity and support for Christianity in contemporary India. And so there just is this assumption that Christians are in India are westward leaning. And then to the extent that part of globalization involves the imposition, the increasingly aggressive imposition of Western political formations on other parts of the world, and particularly the global South, there is a certain fear or insecurity in places like India about whether or not the distinctive nature of Indian politics and society can be preserved in the face of this kind of globalizing force and its particular forms of politics. So in this case, a kind of Western secular modernities. So because of their long association with the West, which is its own kind of construction, and because of the assumption that sort of the Western world is today trying to impose this particular notion of secularism on the rest of the world, there are some anxieties that I think get foisted upon Christians. And part of it is that if you're trying to resist Western secular modernity, you can't resist it as in the abstract. It doesn't exist in a institutional form. So maybe you look about and you see, well, here's this group, these Christians that seem to be, who seem to really like these ideas, seem to purvey them, seem to benefit from them in terms of education and modern ideals, etc. And so you attack that thing which you can see.
Thank you. Could we say a bit more about secularism in the West versus secularism in India? Really, maybe the idea of religion and the extent to which, I don't mean to lead the question, the extent to which the question of whether or not religion can be extricated from culture, from life, from politics, the very notion of secularism. Say a bit about what you discover or argue in your book.
Yeah, so what I argue is that there is something distinctive between the secularism in India and the secularism in a place like the United States. This has been well articulated by lots of people other than me. In the United States, you have a kind of very strong notion that religion and the state should be separate, whereas secularism developed in a slightly different way in India, and in a way that suggests not that that the state should remain aloof from religion, but that it should simply avoid privileging one religious community more than another, supporting one religious community more than another. So, for example, in the Indian constitution and judiciary, you will find far more willingness to intervene in religious affairs than you will find in the United States. To take one, I think, really telling example, the direction of U.S. law in recent years has been to avoid imposing anti-discrimination law in religious contexts. So to preserve the freedom of religious people in religious contexts, and maybe even in public contexts like pizza parlors and bakeries, et cetera, to discriminate in ways against LGBTQ folk, for example, that are otherwise illegal. On the Indian side, you've seen far more of a willingness of the Indian government to intervene to enforce non-discrimination law, even in religious contexts, particularly in Hindu contexts, which is one of the things that angers Hindus, that they feel that that the government is imposing certain kind of liberal progressive ideals in Hindu contexts that they don't impose in Muslim and Christian contexts. But the conflict and the controversy of the Sabarimala temple in the last couple of years is a good example of this, where the government has sort of weighed in to say that you cannot, even for religious reasons, disallow the attendance of women of a certain age at your temple. because that runs afoul of anti-gender discrimination laws. So there are differences there. But there's also differences, as you alluded to, and as I talk about in the book, between the conception of religion that informs these ideas of secularism. So everyone knows that in the sort of post-Enlightenment Western world, there was this movement to understand religion as a private thing that could be easily separated from politics, from economics, and from government. That was not the case in the pre-Enlightenment world. Of course, you know, in the sort of Middle Ages, Catholicism and government were all kind of mixed up with each other. But in the post-Enlightenment world, there was that move to separate those two. So now in the Western world, we function for the most part with this notion of religion that suggests it is this distinct thing that we can find very easily the lines separating religion from politics, and that religions should stay away from politics, should stay away from it. In India, you have a different trajectory. You have a trajectory of Hinduism as an ethnic religion, and even Jainism, Buddhism as essentially ethnic religions that tend to attach themselves to a particular people in a particular land. You have a notion of religion that suggests that it's about spiritual advance, which can happen in any religious tradition. And therefore, out of respect, you should stay on your own and you shouldn't go meddling in other people's. And if you have that kind of conception of religion, then you may resist giving people the right to proselytize, because it implies that religion is this kind of personal choice, a private affair, separate from communities. It implies that religion is portable, that you know there can be a Christian Indian and a Christian American and a Christian Nigerian, and you know that makes perfect sense. So these different kinds of understandings of what religion is and should be inform notions about the ideal form of politics, the ideal form of secularism, and also the limits of religious freedom. So, I mean, one of the most pertinent questions in India today is proselytization a fundamental right of religious people because Christians want to do it and some other religious communities want to do it? Or is it something that a decent government, for good reason, could prohibit or restrict because, according to a very typical kind of Hindu understandings of religion, proselytization is kind of unnecessary and superfluous. So you could have full, decent religious freedom without having the right to proselytize. And that certainly plays into the conflict between Hindus and Christians.
That's fascinating. The proselytization question I find particularly fascinating and relevant, ever relevant, as we figure out how to engage folks of various stripes in these textured societies we live in. What surprised you the most about your research, if anything? What were you interested to discover? Or was it all fairly intuitive to you from the outset?
I think there were... I'm gonna have to think about that one a little bit. I think that there were a lot of things that could have been predicted. I was not expecting to come to the thesis I came to in this book. I think initially I was persuaded by the kind of political and economic and caste-oriented arguments about the nature and the causes of anti-Christian violence and Hindu-Christian conflict more generally. I still accept all of those theses as good as far as they go. It's just that I also came to understand that there was this other element, one that was related to global dynamics and not just local dynamics, that people just weren't really talking about. So I think the thesis of this book, you know, that tries to elevate that particular dynamic of this sort of resistance to Western secular modernities, that was a bit of a surprise to me. I was also surprised, because it happened right in the middle of the research, that the kind of low-level Hindu-Christian conflict that I had seen in the years from, say, 1998 to 2007 spilled over into this large-scale riot in Orissa in 2007 and 2008. And really, we should say large-scale series of riots, because it wasn't just one riot, and they went on for about a month in the end of 2007, early 2008, and then they started back up again at the end of 2008. So I wasn't expecting that, and one of the reasons I wasn't expecting that was because historically there had been kind of a difference between anti-Muslim violence in India and anti-Christian violence in India. Anti-Muslim violence in India there was a long history of Hindu-Muslim riots that where there would be dozens or hundreds of victims of violence, dozens or hundreds of deaths. But that really had not been a feature of conflict between Hindus and Christians until Kandamal. And still here, it was, we're talking about dozens of deaths instead of hundreds of deaths, as we sometimes see in the violence between Hindus and Muslims. But so I guess, it was a surprise to me, partly because it happened right in the middle of my research. And at a time when I was really focusing on these isolated kind of everyday incidents of violence against Christians, I just didn't expect there to ever be that kind of large-scale riot violence like we saw in Orissa in 2007 and 2008. So I would say those are the two main things that really surprised me. It's a bit of a difficult question to answer because I've been at this now for 12 years. it's hard to think back to the moments when I first realized something was out of the ordinary, something that I didn't expect. At this point, it all seems kind of expected.
Was there anything else about the book you hoped we'd touch on?
No, I think that's it. I mean, what I would say about the book is that it is a sincere attempt to write a book that makes arguments that can be heard by both parties in Hindu-Christian conflict. It's an attempt to acknowledge and pay attention to some of the grievances that Hindus have about Christianity and some of the grievances that Indians more generally have about their place in the world and about their interactions with the Western world, on the one hand. On the other hand, it is obviously also an attempt to take seriously the fact that there are Christians in India who live in fear, particularly at certain times, of becoming the victim of violence. And that's a problem that any Indian and any member of the international community should be concerned about. I also tried really hard in the book to contextualize and clarify the scope of the problem. I think one additional surprise in doing this research was realizing when I did a per capita analysis that the number of incidents of anti-Christian violence in India in any given year, so let's say on a given year there might be 300, is again per capita in terms of the number of Indians fewer than the number of hate crimes recorded in America by the FBI against Muslims, again, per capita, and far fewer per capita than the number of hate crimes registered against Jewish people in the United States in any given year. So this is not a book which is meant to draw attention to how things are so horrible in India. It's a book which is intended to shed light on and try to understand a particular conflict, while acknowledging that this conflict in India is both related to and not entirely different from conflicts that we have elsewhere in the world, including in the United States.
Thank you. Now, given that it's been 12 years and you finally popped this out, book gestations are more like Mahabharata gestations, are much more than a year, right? They take a while.
That's right.
Is there another bun in the oven, or what are you working on now?
So, of course, just a few days ago, an edited volume, the Handbook of Hindu-Christian Relations, the Routledge Handbook of Hindu-Christian Relations, came out. That's a book that Michelle Voss Roberts and I edited. We've been working on for 3 years with an absolutely fantastic class of scholars, many of them associated with the Society for Hindu-Christian Studies. So that's just come out, and we are, Michelle and I are going to continue that work with a soon to be announced special issue of a journal that would focus on the same topic, but through case studies instead of more general overviews like we had in the handbook. That's one project. I'm also involved in some sort of side projects. One, actually a kind of limited time frame one, looking at a couple of mega churches in India. Mega churches are not my style of religion, but I do find them fascinating, and they're politically important. And so I'm going to be working on a little side project there for a little while. I've also been shifting a little bit, and I'm going to begin writing more about Hindu concerns about religious freedom in India and elsewhere, including, for example, in the context of the Sabarimala affair and the willingness of the Indian government to interfere in Hindu religious affairs in ways that concern some Hindus. And I'm also hoping in maybe about a year or two out to really pivot and start doing some work on the marginalization, oppression of Hindus in Christian contexts. Probably not the United States, since we already have excellent scholars working on that here in the United States, but in places like Fiji and Trinidad, South Africa, for example. So essentially, I'm looking to invert the projects that I've been working on for the last decade or so. Instead of looking at Christian minorities in a Hindu-dominated context, I'll be looking at Hindu minorities in Christian-dominated contexts.
So then we'll have to have you back on the podcast for part two, for the flip side.
I'd love it, of course.
And the podcast, of course, has a sufficiently broad title now to accommodate pretty much anything, any of the projects that you're producing. Speaking of which, we'll have you and Michelle on the podcast very soon to talk about the handbook. So that's something to look forward to.
Great.
For those listening out there. Thank you very much for speaking with me today about your work.
I'm honored. Thanks. It's been a real pleasure.
Pleasure's been mine. So for those of you listening, we have been talking with Dr. Chad Bauman on his brand new publication, Anti-Christian Violence in India, Cornell University Press. Until next time, keep listening, stay safe, stay sane, and keep contemplating the texture of what we call Indian religions. Take care.